Funding for Here and Now Anytime comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
Hey there, it's Chris Bentley, host of Here and Now Anytime. Let me ask you a quick favor. It's easy, but important to me and everyone who works on this show. If you like that we're here every afternoon, bringing you fresh perspectives and insightful conversations on the big stories of the day, take 5 seconds and follow Here and Now Anytime, wherever you're listening to this podcast right now. And if you want to make us really happy and help other people find this show, leave us a good review. It really helps. And thanks. Now here's the show.
We're worried about a lot of things that can go wrong when both a parent and teen are anxious and depressed. And we're trying to move things in a direction where parents and teens can actually be helpful to each other.
Teenagers and mental health. New research says if you want to help your kids, first, take a look at yourself. It's Thursday, April 25th, and this is Here and Now Anytime from NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm Chris Bentley. Today on the show, is your kid just moody or struggling with mental health? Also, in the U.S., it can be tough to find a working charger for your electric car. Not so much in China.
And you can see that they're really going for it. And every year they kind of install more chargers than we might even expect.
A look at the market for EVs around the world coming up in a few minutes. But first, what happened after the 2020 election is suddenly top of mind again today in Arizona. Rudy Giuliani, Mark Meadows, and several other members of former President Trump's inner circle have been indicted for trying to overturn the results of Arizona's presidential election. Arizona Attorney General Chris Mays made the announcement yesterday.
Arizona's election was free and fair. The people of Arizona elected President Biden. Unwilling to accept this fact, the defendants charged by the state grand jury allegedly schemed to prevent the lawful transfer of the presidency.
The indictment includes 11 other state Republicans who are accused of signing false documents to transfer the state's electoral votes to Trump instead of Biden. Arizona is now the fourth state to bring charges against so-called fake electors. And the news came on the same day as a vote to repeal a Civil War-era abortion ban in Arizona. So we went to Jeremy Duda, a longtime political reporter in Arizona. He writes for Axios in Phoenix. He spoke to our own Arizonan, Peter O'Dowd.
And wow, what a week in state politics. Two banner headlines today on the front page of the Arizona Republic. The first one says, fake electors in Arizona indicted in huge print. What do we need to know?
Well, this is an investigation that began last year after our then new Attorney General, Democrat Chris Mays, took office. It began with the 11 Republicans who cast false electoral votes for Trump here in after the 2020 election, as Trump electors did in a number of other states. Joe Biden won the state by a little over 10,000 votes. He was the first Democrat since 1996 to win Arizona in a presidential election. And there were no outstanding legal challenges by the Trump campaign left in Arizona, to my knowledge. They cast their electoral votes as part of, according to the indictment, as part of this plot to overturn the results and install Trump for another term.
Before the indictment yesterday, several of these high-profile state Republicans, there are state lawmakers in the mix, people who had run the party or were running the party at the time, they had defended their choice to falsely submit the state's electoral votes for Trump. But what's been the response now that they've been charged with a crime?
I mean, the responses have been pretty predictable, I think, along the same lines we've seen in other states where this happened. You know, they did nothing wrong, that this was legal. This was a contingency plan in case the legal challenges changed the result of the election. As I mentioned, I don't believe there are any outstanding challenges, at least not from the Trump campaign in Arizona at the time. But, you know, on the other side, Democrats and Republican and, you know, a smaller number of Republicans who are, you know, opposed to Trump or opposed to the fake electors, you know, cheered the decision. It's been something that has been kind of a long time coming to some folks. You know, Chris Mays, in the video she put out when the indictments were announced, said, yeah, I know this hasn't gone fast enough for some people, but kind of defended the amount of time it took. In Arizona, we had a Republican attorney general through the end of 2022. Mm-hmm. So this started, you know, just a few months after Attorney General Mays took office.
Trump is not named in these charging documents, but clearly described as an unindicted co-conspirator. Is there any indication that the attorney general might bring charges against him in Arizona the way that, for example, Georgia did in a similar case?
Not that I've seen. I would expect that this is kind of what you see is what you get here with the 11 fake electors and the seven others whose names have not been, you know, officially revealed, but everyone kind of figured it out pretty quickly, especially since a lot of them have faced charges in other states. There's five unindicted co-conspirators. One's obviously Trump. We have the seven others whose names have not been revealed. Some of them stand out pretty obviously. The mayor, Rudy Giuliani, Mark Meadows, Trump's chief of staff.
Okay. Now, the other major development in Arizona yesterday was at the state capitol when three Republicans joined Democrats in the House to repeal this 1864 ban on nearly all abortions in the state. This was the third time that Democrats tried to repeal the law. It worked this time, and it was a very emotional day on the House floor. How much of a political earthquake was this vote in Arizona?
This is a pretty big one. You know, in both chambers of the legislature, the Republicans only have a one-vote majority. And so in both chambers, Democrats needed at least two Republicans to come along with them. And the big stumbling block had been that the House Speaker, Ben Thoma, was very opposed, adamantly opposed to repealing the ban or to allowing a vote on this. Yesterday, we did see finally, after a couple of weeks of arm-twisting, supporters of the repeal were able to get a second Republican, Representative Tim Dunn from Yuma, to go along with Representative Matt Gress, the first Republican who'd been very vocal on this. And we saw a third Republican, Representative Justin Wilmoth, vote to repeal the ban as well.
That choice came with some consequences for at least one of those Republicans you mentioned. Matt Gress lost his committee assignment, you know, right after this vote. So lots of pressure on Republicans as this heads to the Senate now. Do you think there's enough support to get this repealed to the governor's desk?
It's pretty clear there's enough support now. The big question mark was the House. You know, this could have gone on for weeks. We weren't quite sure. Now it looks like we will probably see a resolution to this next week.
As this issue does, both sides very energized here after this vote. Do you think a successful effort to repeal the 1864 ban could affect the outcome of this ballot initiative in November that would enshrine the right to an abortion in the state's constitution?
It is possible. I mean, Representative Dunn put out a statement basically saying that is why he voted to repeal the ban, that he wanted to try and head off the ballot measure that he views as much more extreme. There's still a lot of campaigning, a lot of hand-wringing and arguing left to go.
Jeremy Duda follows state politics for Axios in Phoenix. Thank you.
And thanks for having me.
Coming up next, China makes up an increasingly large share of global demand for electric vehicles. And not coincidentally, they're also leading the way in building new chargers. After the break, our Reverse Course series considers the state of EV sales and EV charging in China and also here in the US, starting with a look at a new wireless charging road in Detroit. Peter picks it up after the break.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify's there to help you grow. Sell without needing to code or design. Just bring your best ideas and Shopify will help you open up shop. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/NPR.
Support for NPR and the following message come from Carvana, on a mission to make car buying more convenient and affordable than ever before. In minutes, you can browse thousands of options under $20,000. Visit Carvana.com or download the app today to get started.
Is it possible to engineer our way out of the climate crisis? Some entrepreneurs want to shoot particles into the stratosphere to combat global warming. Experts say regulations on this technology aren't keeping up. The world of solar geoengineering on the latest episode of The Sunday Story from NPR's Up First podcast.
Drivers will buy 17 million electric vehicles this year, according to the International Energy Agency, meaning one in five cars sold worldwide will be EVs. It's a lot of cars that need a lot of places to charge. This week, our series Reverse Course is looking at ways to clean up transportation, and today, the state of EVs and EV charging, starting with a novel idea in Michigan. Detroit is testing a new way to charge that doesn't require plugging in. Just drive your car on the right strip of road and watch the battery fill up. Justine Johnson is Chief Mobility Officer with the state of Michigan's Office of Future Mobility and Electrification. Justine, welcome.
Thank you so much, and thank you for having me.
This sounds so high-tech. Tell us about what people will see if they go to this section of road in Detroit and what they'll be able to do if they drive their EVs on it.
Right. So a vehicle will be connecting to a smart road. So essentially, the road has a wireless inductive charging coil inside of the road, and the vehicle is communicating with the actual coils underneath the road to receive their charge. So essentially, while a vehicle is driving, as long as it has the receiver underneath the vehicle, you charge and you drive at the same time, really maintaining your charge, but also adding some charge range to that as well.
It reminds me of like the cell phone charger that you can just place your phone on to get a charge. Is the technology
Absolutely.
Similar?
Yes, same thing. Same okay. thing when you think about anywhere you go and you put your cell phone down and it has essentially a way in which you can charge your phone without plugging it into the wall.
I've read the plan is to eventually expand this technology to a 1 mile loop around Michigan Central where it could power a shuttle bus that runs from a parking garage to several buildings in the area. And essentially because of this strip, it would never have any downtime because it's more or less always charging, as you say. Is that the kind of use that you imagine for this?
Yeah, I mean, there's so many different opportunities for this. First, you have dynamic charging. Again, that's while you're driving your vehicle is charging. And then there's static charging. So if you're parking your car at a parking lot, as long as your parking spaces have essentially that same technology there, you can also charge while you're parking your car. So there's two different pieces to this. In terms of, you know, interesting use cases here, you know, I really think that there's such a great opportunity, especially around micro transit. So essentially smaller shuttles that might be moving people. You think about public transportation. Those are also really great potential opportunities as well. I think also for those who are thinking about transitioning their fleets and understand how these vehicles can hold their range while they're driving or how they can be charged at a depot.
The Biden administration wants half of all new car sales to be electric by 2030, and federal money will be used in your state to build 41 more charging stations this year alone. What's your status? I mean, do you have enough chargers in the state of Michigan to sustain demand for new EVs?
For us, the big focus, we have a state plan called the My Future Mobility Plan. We have a goal for 100,000 chargers to be put in place by 2030 to support 2 million passenger EVs. And we still have a lot more to go, I will say that. Another part of this dialogue is really around this type of technology and innovation and how we can add more assets to be this option for charging. So this is really about making sure that we're providing a mix of charging solutions from level one all the way to DC fast and inductive road charging.
But this is hard work. As I'm sure you know, some of the big three in Detroit have pulled back on EV production. Do you think that electric vehicles are still the future for car makers and for the United States?
Yeah, I do think they're still very important to this dialogue. I think We will continue to see more automakers in particular look at electric vehicles to be a big priority. It also eliminates this concept of range anxiety that people are having when they're thinking about what's their next vehicle purchase. I always tell folks that typically you don't have anxiety when your gas light comes on because you know that there's gas stations available. And the more that we continue to invest in electric vehicle charging infrastructure, the less this conversation will be about range anxiety.
Justine Johnson is Michigan's Chief Mobility Officer. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let's take a step back from Michigan now. Tesla announced more layoffs yesterday and said it plans to roll out new, more affordable vehicles next year. The company's stock has been in a tailspin. And while Tesla might be a special case, other American carmakers have also tapped the brakes just a little bit on EVs. Ryan Fisher is an analyst for Bloomberg NEF, and he joins me now. Ryan, welcome.
Yeah, thanks, Peter. Thanks for having me.
Sure. So, you know, we just heard about this road in Detroit that can charge an electric vehicle just by driving over it. Fascinating technology, but big picture, what is the state of EV charging in the United States right now? We got the Biden administration has a goal of creating a national network of 500,000 publicly available chargers by 2030. Are we anywhere near that?
Yeah. So in the U.S., I think what you've seen is it be behind other regions. China's well out in front, kind of installing almost 1 million public chargers last year. The US kind of down in the low tens of thousands. And then Europe somewhere in between. And one of the reasons for this is kind of lower EV sales as a whole. Things are kind of moving, but overall a bit stagnant in comparison to like when we look at Europe.
We also hear all these stories of people pulling up to charge their cars at a public charging station and they don't work. Why is that such a problem?
So it's a super interesting one. So I used to work at Jaguar Land Rover, and they had chargers from all different manufacturers. And occasionally they wouldn't work, or quite often they wouldn't work. And sometimes it'll be like the car is sending a signal, and the charger expects it, or the car expects it to the signal to go every like 1 second or something. And then the other one is sending the signal every 2 seconds. Basically, those communications are a problem. So that standardization is taking a bit of time. And the other side of it is the business model of, are they being funded in the right way, such that somebody cares about them being upgraded? The US, when you look across it, has had more free chargers. And as we kind of know, in a way, something that's free either gets neglected or not used very well. And if it's free as well, the other person in that store, you might look at it and go, actually, I'm not really so bothered about maintaining that or caring about it.
So that's the charging side of this story. But let's just talk in general about the market for EVs. We know it is growing, but that sales have really fallen off. Demand is slowing. What's the snapshot of EVs in the United States today?
I think the media could say that there's a bit of a negative sentiment from some of the reality. And part of that is some truth. Like growth is slowing. So you can read an article or a headline and it says EVs are down, everything's going really bad. But the reality was last year, EV sales in the US were up over 40% or somewhere around that number. Most businesses would be pretty happy with 40% growth. This year, we're still thinking that it's still going to be double-digit growth, maybe 20 to 30%, I think, in our forecast. But clearly, interest rates have bitten not just the EV market, but the whole auto sector. And if money is expensive to borrow, then less people are going to go out there and buy new cars. Also, the US as a whole has not got some of the same dynamics as perhaps Europe, where you've got maybe stricter fuel economy regulations, but you've also got Chinese manufacturers able to come in, the tariffs being slightly lower, which means that they basically got to build those EVs now, whereas I think the US automakers have perhaps seen a bit of an opportunity to slow this down, and that sort of feeds a bit of negative sentiment to the market.
You know, I was recently in a BYD Chinese-built EV for the first time while I was working on a story for the series in Costa Rica. You can't get these cars in the United States. China is by far the largest market for EVs. It makes up 59% of the sales last year. I wonder, just comment on the state of China's EV market and what it's doing that other countries might be able to look at and adopt.
Yeah, so I think we're on something like 10% of sales being EV in America, North America. In China, I think they're talking about it getting up to 50%. One of the factors is cost. So they're just coming with new products faster with great specifications. And then obviously from a cost point, they kind of own the supply chain. The charging bit comes into it too. So I think the Chinese government has kind of realized, well, we want to own the auto market. And charging matters. So if we're going to sell a lot of EVs in our country, we'll put charging out. And you can see that they're really going for it. And every year they kind of install more chargers than we might even expect.
Ryan Fisher is an analyst with Bloomberg NEF, talking about the state of electric vehicles in the United States and beyond. Ryan, thank you so much.
Thank you, Peter.
Check out all our reporting on climate solutions in transportation at hereandnow.org. Just look for Reverse Course. Coming up, the rate of kids dealing with serious mental health issues has been on the rise since the pandemic. But if parents want to help their kids, research suggests they should look at themselves and their own mental health. Peter has the story when we return.
Listen to Embedded for moments that stay with you.
I could smell the smoke. I could smell the dust.
Voices that resonate. Stories that change the way you think about your life.
How did we get here?
The Embedded podcast is NPR's home for original documentary series. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
On Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, we have very important people on our show and then ask them about very unimportant things. Here's U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen.
We are also reliably informed that among your enthusiasms, in addition to macroeconomic policy, is mobile games.
There is some truth in that.
There's some truth in that.
Join us for the NPR podcast that considers all the other things. That's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Why is everyone so obsessed with traditional wives or trad wives on social media? This week, we're talking about the viral videos of women making marshmallows and mozzarella from scratch, and how behind the sheen of calm kitchens and cute fits, there's some interesting pessimism about our modern world. And that's worth digging into. Next time on It's Been a Minute from NPR.
Do you ever wish you could get your stories in 3 hours rather than 3 minutes? Or maybe you're sick of doom scrolling, getting your news in bits and pieces. That is where Embedded comes in. We bring you documentary series that will change the way you think about things. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
If you have a teenager at home, you might find yourself occasionally wondering, is this kid just moody or is he really struggling? This can be a tough thing to tell sometimes, and it's a question that parents are asking themselves as more and more kids deal with serious mental health issues after the pandemic. But if you want to help your kids, research suggests parents and caregivers might want to take a look at themselves and their own mental health. Richard Weisbord is faculty director of the Making Caring Common Project at Harvard's Graduate School of Education. He joins us now. Welcome. It's good to speak with you.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
And why don't we start with that question that I just posed there at the top. Is my kid a typical hormonal teenager who's trying to navigate this new body and this electrifying idea of becoming an adult? Or is something deeper going on? How do we know?
Well, I think you're right to point out that a lot of teenagers are under stress. It's perfectly normal. A lot of us are under stress during these times, and it can be easy to confuse normal stress and normal anxiety with more serious anxiety and depression. But depression and anxiety, real depression and anxiety, you know, tend to have pretty defined symptoms. You know, when kids are depressed, they're often not eating well, they're not sleeping well, they're withdrawing from social activities. It can be really moody and really irritable in a way that's very different than normal moodiness and irritability. Very normal for teens to be distracted, but when they're seem consistently distracted and down, it's at least time to be curious and to engage them in understanding, you know, what's going on and how they're doing.
Your research explores this link between kids' mental health and parents. And you found that while the kids are having a hard time, we know that, right? So are their parents. Tell me more.
Well, you know, one of the things that's been, you know, in some ways odd about this discussion about the teen mental health crisis is that young adults in our research are doing, you know, in a sense, twice as bad or twice as concerning as teens. Their rates of depression and anxiety are twice the rates of teens. And parents are suffering anxiety, depression about the same rate as teens. So we would be just as right to sound the alarm about a parent or caregiver mental health crisis than about a teen mental health crisis. And, you know, a depressed teen, a depressed parent can set each other off in all kinds of ways. They can, you know, a depressed teen can withdraw, which can make a parent feel unloved, which can make a parent more depressed, vice versa. And at the same time, a depressed parent, anxious parent, you know, often has a lot of wisdom and anxiety about anxiety and depression that they can share with their teen. So, you know, we're worried about a lot of things that can go wrong when both a parent and teen are anxious and depressed. And we're trying to move things in a direction where parents and teens can actually be helpful to each other in these situations.
Let's talk more about that. But first, I want to dig into this idea that the two may be connected, parents and kids, because I know that, you know, in my house, when my teenager is suffering, the entire family suffers, right? It's this tough, tough cycle to get out of.
Yeah. 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 No, these can be really tough cycles to get out of. And, you know, for parents, you know, our well-being is often so tied to how well our kids are doing. So when a kid is doing really well, and if you're a parent who's already vulnerable to anxiety and depression, you may feel anxious and depressed. And when you're anxious and depressed, it's harder to be emotionally available to your teen and patient and steady in the way that teens often really need. So that's how these negative cycles can start. And that's why it's so important to break these cycles early.
40% of the teenagers that you surveyed say that they wanted their parents to reach out more and just to ask, how are they doing? How are you really doing? To listen to them. And I was surprised that that number was so high, that parents weren't already doing that. And so I wonder, what's keeping parents from listening to their kids?
You know, I think it's a couple of things. And, you know, just to add to the data that you just shared, when teens are not anxious or depressed, they're more likely to go to their parents for advice or help than their friends. But our data show that when teens are anxious and depressed, they're more likely to go to their friends than to their parents. And I think one of the reasons is that, you know, sometimes when a teen is worried that a parent is depressed and they don't want to burden their parents, I think sometimes they're worried that their parents will be, if they come with a concern, their parents will be really upset or anxious in ways that won't be constructive. You know, one of the things we find in our data is that teens perceive their parents as very focused on achievement. And I think sometimes teens worry that parents will feel like when they're anxious or depressed, it's going to undermine their achievement, and parents are going to respond more in terms of achievement than in terms of really understanding what a teen is going through and trying to be helpful.
Yeah. You know, plus when there's issues of anxiety or depression, that can show itself through anger or distance or sadness, making it even harder to stay connected and to listen or to be attuned to your kid. I mean, how can parents do a better job listening, do you think?
You know, I think it's important for parents to recognize that even when they are anxious and depressed, they, you know, they've often learned a lot, have developed coping strategies. They have a lot to provide to their kids, even in those situations. And, you know, I think part of this is that parents don't have confidence that they can be helpful to their kids when I think they can be helpful to their kids. I also think that parents are often themselves isolated, and that isolation is a significant cause of anxiety and depression. And that when parents are able to maintain strong relationships with their partners, with friends outside their families, when they have sufficient support, they're far more likely to be emotionally available to their kids and able to listen and connect to their kids.
Is it a good idea for parents to be upfront about their own mental health challenges with their kids, or do you think that would cause more worry and more burden for the children?
You know, generally, and you know, this is Bill Beardsley's research, it can be enormously helpful for parents when they are experiencing a significant depression, for example, to say to their kid, I am experiencing a significant depression. And the reason is that kids often blame themselves, that, you know, when you are depressed, you often withdraw, you're often moody, you become angry very suddenly in ways that are frightening to a kid. And kids think there's something wrong with them. And when a parent can say, this isn't about you, this is about something I'm experiencing, it can provide, you know, enormous relief to a teen, and it can make the world make sense again. That doesn't mean that parents should be, you know, talking a lot about their depression, anxiety, and expecting their kids to be in a therapeutic role with them or burdening their kids with them. It's important when parents do talk about depression, anxiety with their kids, that they also convey that they're managing it, that they're doing something about it to get help, because it can be, you know, frightening for a kid to think that a parent's depression, anxiety might, you know, spiral out of control in some way.
I want to end by going back to the root causes of some of these challenges. You know, we've been talking about this problem with kids who've gone through all sorts of hardships during the pandemic, but, you know, I assume you've been looking at this issue for much longer than that, or just the past few years. What do you think is, what's going on here?
I think there are a lot of things going on, and they differ by race and culture and class. That what's going on with affluent kids is really different than what's going on with low-income kids in many respects. That, you know, in many middle and upper-class communities, I do worry about achievement pressure becoming so excessive. And when we ask teens, you know, we give them a list of things that might be negatively influencing their mental health, achievement pressure comes up number one, and the amount of stress. And we also find that teens are lonely, and we find that teens feel like they have little or no meaning or purpose in their life. You know, about 30% or a third feel like they have little or no meaning or purpose in their life. You know, I think the loss of faith-based communities, religion, so many fewer people are observing is concerning in many ways. I'm not suggesting that people should suddenly become more religious, but, you know, religion...
It's the community, though. Isn't it the community absence that you're community, that you're really referring to?
Community is really important, and the sense of purpose and meaning that faith-based communities can provide. There are structures in religious communities for dealing with trauma and grief and loss that can be very important to teens. So again, my point is not that we should suddenly become more religious. My point is we have to think about how to reproduce those aspects of religion in secular life.
Richard Weisbord is the faculty director of the Making Caring Common Project at Harvard's Graduate School of Education. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been great to be here.
We talk about mental health on this show regularly, and we want to know, do you have a question about mental health? What conversations do you want to hear on the topic? If you've got any thoughts or questions that you want answered, just click the link in the show notes or email us at letters@hereandnow.org. That'll do it for us today. This show comes from the team behind Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston. Today's stories were produced by Lynn Menegon, Sam Rafelson, and me, Chris Bentley. Today's editors were Julia Corcoran, Micaela Rodriguez, Michael Scotto, and Kat Welch. Technical direction from Mike Moschetto and Caleb Green. Mike Moschetto also wrote our theme music, along with Max Liebman and me. Our digital producers are Allison Hagen and Grace Griffin. And the executive producer of Here and Now is Carlene Watson. Thanks for listening. See you next time.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Stearns & Foster. Every Stearns & Foster mattress is handcrafted for irresistible comfort with indulgent memory foam and ultra-conforming IntelliCoils for your most comfortable sleep. Learn more at stearnsandfoster.com. This message comes from NPR sponsor Betterment. The emotional build of a will-they-won't-they love story is never chill, but your investing portfolio should be. Betterment is the investing app that lets you be totally chill about your finances. Their automated technology and tax-smart tools are easy to set up, so you can focus on navigating any will-they-won't-they love stories that come your way. Betterment. Be invested and totally chill. Learn more at Betterment.com. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed.
I'm Jesse Thorne. Why did Cola Scola write a bonkers, extremely fictionalized play about Mary Todd Lincoln?
Well, you know, it was 2020 and we were all so isolated. I just started doing research. But the truth is, I just thought of it.
We'll talk about that and more on Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR.